Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey everybody, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and today I have with me my friend Tamal. Tamal is a mentor, storyteller, social philosopher, retreat leader, and ceremonialist. He's also a painter, a dancer, a hermit, and a preposterous clown. Tamal has been studying and teaching ancestral wisdom traditions for 27 years. Among other things, he was a monk for 11 years based in India and trained in shamanism in Peru for 4 years after that. His summary conclusion about life is that our task is to transform our paradigm of duality into one of polarity. A fundamental part of this process is a reorientation towards suffering. Tamal founded his
Sri Ramana Purnima.
Yes, thank you. He founded that school of prayer in 2020. The online aspect of the school is the Moonshine Mandali community opening this month. Welcome, Tamal.
Hey, thanks, Rachel.
I'm grateful that you're here. And to introduce you, I would love to start with, do you know your Enneagram number?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. I'm a 4.
Okay, and how do you think that shows up for you? How does that resonate from what you know?
I figured that out decades ago, and I haven't studied the Enneagram in a long time. But what I remember as a 4 is the individualist, which means it's a inborn passionate instinct to live my own way, you know, to be authentic to myself, which isn't to say individualism. Individualism is like isolation. And, right. You know, the individualist is, I think you can only accomplish your individuation. In the words of Carl Jung, his like code language, for enlightenment, when he was actually talking about enlightenment, the full potential of the human being, his code word was individuation, to become a real individual. So you're no longer just a reaction to the way you were raised, the society, your values that you were raised with, or a response, coping mechanisms from your childhood traumas and things, but you're actually making free-willing choices about exactly who you want to be and how you want to be. That's what he called individuation. He said the great work of a human being is to individuate, to come out of the herd mentality, to come out of, like, you know, wean off the teat of the collective unconscious and become fully responsible for your own conscious life. As opposed to individualism, which is, I think it would be impossible to individuate if you didn't take into consideration that you are part of an ecosystem of life. You're something unique, but you are... And that's a fine line between being just an echo of what has happened to you and what happens around you, and being a conscious response, you know, to everything that your environment needs, you know.
Yeah. Well, you personify that very well. Like, I cannot think of a more 4 than and which leads me to some of your experiences. So can you give us a cultural upbringing and background, like, tell us about that for you.
Yeah, I mean, the truest thing I could say about where I come from is the land where I'm from. You know, I was born and raised in Miami, which behind the veil of metropolis is actually a very rich natural landscape. You know, banyan trees and streets flooding with warm tropical rain and so many kinds of fruits that have been successfully transplanted from all over the world. Just, it's a very abundant, rich place. Lots of hidden. After school, I used to go to the gigantic botanical gardens and climb in through a hole in the fence. Every day, I would go to the botanical gardens in Rome, and it's it's an extremely fertile environment, and the breeze off of the ocean. I grew up for a while on a sailboat, and the breeze off the ocean is positively intoxicating. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's so life-giving and rich, especially when there is so much metropolis. The breath of the Everglades from one side, you know, and the breath of the ocean from the other side, which way mm-hmm. the wind is coming, is so life-nourishing for a sensitive organic person.
Yeah.
And so I'm from there. I would say culturally, more than anything, I'm from the banyan trees and mangoes and mangroves and warm ocean and you know, heavy rain. And that's where I think I'm best described as being from. It hugely informed my personality, the plants I grew up around. My parents were non-practicing Catholics, and you know, my grandparents, I got impressions from my grandmothers of religion, you know, mm-hmm. or my one side was Catholic and one side Episcopalian. And I remember going to midnight mass and stuff once a year, but my parents didn't teach me any religion really. So mostly my father was a tree planter and fruits and flowers and very green thumb and a sailor and traveler and really the kind of cultural, again, imprint I got from my direct family, my parents, was more about the landscape, the ocean and the plants, which I'm very grateful for. And then of course, Miami, also the other side of Miami is my, you know, my home was robbed maybe 8 times, you know, they would break in to the house. And I remember coming home and the house was broken into and the Christmas tree was knocked over and all the presents were stolen. And ribbons and stuff through the backyard where they had escaped, where the robbers had escaped through the yard. And, you know, so there's a lot of crime and a lot of a very dark, you know, it was the 80s when I grew up and there had been a release of criminals and insane people from sent over from Fidel Castro. And so Miami became very dark very fast in the 1980s. And so it's a, where I'm from is complex, you know, extremely fertile and beautiful and rich, nourishing, juicy fruits and beautiful, you know, ocean sparkling with the moonlight in the night and the, you know, just glorious place to feel in your body and also a place to feel very afraid and unsafe. And like most of Latin America, in my experience, like South America is so gloriously beautiful and so haunted by crime and destabilized, you know, not everywhere, obviously, but it's, Miami's a complex place and I love her. I love it very much. Mm. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from culturally, so to speak. Other things about where somebody comes from culturally, I guess, means like the traumas and inherited traumas, you know, of your lineage. Where I come from is also a lot of madness, a lot of mental illness. You know, I come from a lifetime of depression also, struggling for decades to survive very heavy suicidal depression at times, and grown up around people of all varieties of mental illness and difficulty and struggle and faith and kindness and all that kind of stuff, you know. That's like a little snapshot where I'm coming from starting off. But culturally also, like, I spent most of my adult life overseas, which also has been, I'm still growing, you know, I'm still growing up, so I'm also culturally from, you know, more than a decade in India, and I'm culturally from living in the high mountains of the Sacred Valley of Peru for 4 years. You know, I'm culturally from third world places also, where I've lived and shaped by the values and the people and the simplicity, you know, of a less bureaucratic existence than you get in the States, for example. So-called first world.
Yeah, so-called. Which is why your experiences are so incredibly fascinating. Like, I read your intro and I know I said it today, I was like, it's just the coolest experiences that you've had, but mainly the wisdom and what you know is why I'm like, I have to have you on the podcast so we can talk about what I know wouldn't be a grief podcast without talking and diving into some deep waters, which is where we are going today. The deep waters of the intersection of loss and what we've experienced in loss with suffering and how it relates to our understanding of God, the scaffolding we might have come from, in that intersection that comes up when we're suffering. I have interviewed a couple of chaplains and talked to several, and what I find fascinating is that the chaplains choose a career where they're going in to meet people when they're in their darkest time and their darkest suffering, but they're coming from a faith lens. But what's fascinating to me about that is their scaffolding they grew up, or their construct that they've decided to be in service of with other people, they're going to come across people who don't have that same scaffolding or that same construct. But yet there is a moment where all of them talk about where when they're together, there, even despite the differences, there is something sacred that is revealed. Like there are moments of connectivity to something divine, something deep within both humans that they're able to connect with in that moment of suffering and either minister to this person or be present, hold that space and be with them despite the difference in scaffolding. And so that's been my experience of time with you and being able to listen to you and you sharing your experiences you've learned, but also what you've learned about the sacred wisdom that you've studied for 27 years over different scaffoldings, different constructs. And it lends to this moment where when I have talked to you, and I've said this to you so many times, but what's helpful for me is it's that own experience of seeing your devotion to God as you understand God only encourages the exploration of my own understanding as God, of God as I understand him. It's like this intersection of the divine is, I can recognize that despite the differences or even with the ones that are there that I think are so beautifully challenging of my own way I perceive things. And so I am grateful that the deep waters that we're diving into, like I am grateful that you were willing to be here and join in this conversation and that you love it as much as I do.
Oh yeah, sure. I do.
Yeah. Yes, you do. Okay. So wanting to dive in the first place is you mentioned part of coming into a relationship with suffering or understanding our relationship with suffering is being able to reorient by way of duality to polarity. And there's a foundation there for us to understand suffering. I'm just going to let you dive right in for us and tell us about what's foundational in this understanding of reorienting to suffering.
Well, just to one half step back, you're mentioning about this, the cross denominational conversations that become meaningful because there's something mm-hmm. universal that happens. It reminds me of like Leonardo da Vinci, who is known for his artwork, but was also, a wrestler and a musician and a poet and a herbologist. And there was a time when we used to have something that we call Renaissance men or Renaissance women. Where that comes from is from the seekers of wisdom in the past, and you know, the building of European culture, for example. There were alchemists. You know, they were astrologers, they were the philosophers, the thinkers that gave wisdom. Those who were dedicated full-time to understanding life would give wisdom to the, like, administrators, kings and queens and things. And then on the basis of that, the kings and queens would lead. Like, you have Arthur, an Arthurian legend led by Merlin, the mystic visionary. And to be one of the kind of advisors that shaped European royal dynasties, the mystic advisors, the visionaries behind the actual royal leaders, you had to study things like astronomy, mathematics, musical scales, and anatomy, and understand what's common here. Mm-hmm. You'd have to be really highly developed in chemistry and music, you know, and French literature or whatever. You would have to have very, very wide and very developed education in many different fields to be able to draw out, to intuit, what are the universal principles of nature and spirit that are actually moving everything? Because if you can grasp that, the universal principles of nature and spirit, then you can speak with relevance to any subject and to any situation, which is why such visionaries who had formed themselves in 5 or 10 or 20 different arts very deeply and understood the correspondence between the stars and scales of music and the human body, they were in touch with those laws that would be able to give them the correct advice for any political situation or any social need. You know, like before Plato, in original old school Greek culture, the philosophers were actually the shamans and healers, like Parmenides. They would crawl into a hole in the ground and fast for 4 days in the dark until they had a vision of the mother who would teach them the laws of nature. You'd had to go like on a vision quest. The Greek philosophers of old weren't just posing questions and talking. They were on a vision quest to learn from the mother, the goddess, who lives underground in the darkness and the mystery. What are the laws of medicine and ruling society, which happen to be the same thing? If you can heal, if you can understand the laws of nature by revelation, then you can create remedies for illnesses, and you can also create remedies for social imbalance. So the original lawmakers were also the healers because they were visionaries, and those were very essential people to society. And so something that all deep thinkers who are really thinking about the real welfare of the individual and of society, you have to think about suffering. You have to think about the most, what is universal? When we talk about universal principles, in the most simple thing, the most simple consideration, everybody wants more pleasure and less pain. And whatever belief system you attach to that, or morals or language and story you tell about it, or whatever your style of pleasure you want more of, somebody wants more pleasure of power and control over others. And somebody wants more pleasure of having a wonderful garden and feeling healthy in their body. You know, but one way or other, according to your conditioning and your makeup, all you really want is to move toward what feels better and move away from what feels bad.
Yeah.
That's the conditioned duality that we're all starting from. That a thinker, a visionary, someone who's going to be useful to healing individuals or helping society be ordered, must take into account what motivates us all. That seems like a simple thing to say, but there's an inborn issue in the duality of, I want more of this experience of life, pleasure, and I don't want that experience of life, pain. And just if you stop and think about it consciously, you will never not have pain. You will never not lose your loved ones. You will never not have disease or misfortune of some kind. You will never not die.
Right.
So the common people, humanity in general, we're running on an unconscious instinct. We haven't thought deeply enough about the duality that from the beginning implies us in a split life, a split existence, where we are in conflict with things that we can never resolve. It's natural to not want to suffer and to not want to die, but you will suffer and you will die. And if you leave it at that, I don't want it, and you just resist it, brace against it, ignore it, coping mechanisms, you know, dissociate or, you know, rebel, drink, whatever it is that you do to not turn and face, like Parmenides and these original philosophers, the founders of original Western culture, for example, they were facing the darkness. They were fasting in the dark, and it was from the darkness that they learned how to bring healing. It was from this underground place, from this dark place. So that's a theme that is not new to anybody who's paying attention to life, that you grow through trial and tribulation, you know, initiation of any culture. To be initiated into adulthood, or to be initiated into a greater understanding of life, to be initiated into the mysteries of life, meaning to have direct understanding of how life works. The doorway was always a crisis of ordeal. Initiation is some kind of crisis. So if we had that approach, that any suffering that I'm facing, from a flu that I don't want to feel, to the uncontrollable breakdown of a family unit, or any kind of calamity that may come, any suffering that we may feel individually, biologically, socially, you know, if we could have the lens try on the possibility that this is a crisis of ordeal meant to initiate me into deep understanding of mysteries that will bring forth wisdom and medicine for myself and for society. What if the evolution of our consciousness and the empowerment of our utility as servants of life depended upon how well we related with suffering? So maybe I just went way on a little,
there. The foundation being first our thought about the purpose of that suffering, that is definitely it. It makes me think of those that would be, and at times are we, I have experienced this when I'm in this space of trying to make sense of something and it feels like there's anger there. There's anger at, let's say, the injustice of something or the questions that come and you hear, like, where is God in this suffering? So it's like it's yes, believing, okay, maybe there's some goodness there, but there's also the resistance to your view of the benevolence of God. Can you go there first?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a debate among theologians and thinking people, right? Religious people, for millennia, for as long as there has been recorded thought about.
But we're going to solve it right now.
Right. Right. Sure.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Finally.
Yes.
There's always like, I have a intimate relation who, when she lost her father, which age does that, takes away people from you. And it wasn't like he was young or untimely, but it was about, a reasonable time to leave the body, to die, to be taken back.
Yeah.
It was so difficult for her that she gave up her faith in God. She's just like, I can't believe that there's a benevolent God if I'm feeling this feeling.
Mm.
Not that she was a profoundly religious person her whole life, but she had spent her life, she had a rosary next to her bed and she believed in God in a general way, but the loss of her father was like something in her rebelled against the idea, the proposal of a benevolent God, because it hurt too much. Mm. It was too important a loss and she just couldn't recover. She's like, nope, I quit. And she signed off. And there's many, many people that one way or another, I remember my original religious thoughts of my own as a early teenager was, I'm suffering too much. There can't be God. That's ridiculous.
Mm.
How can there be God? I see how difficult life is and my life, I'm struggling to exist inside my own mind and heart. There's so much chronic pain through the depression, my particular lens of difficulty, crisis of ordeal, that it's a natural and frequently observed deduction. And I'll say a profoundly immature one, an entirely immature one. It's not really a deep thought. It's just a knee-jerk reaction. There can't be God. And also it's a reaction not to the fact of the mystery of God, but to whatever Sunday school cartoon idea of God we've been fed. That gets shattered for sure. The cartoon of God gets shattered by the reality of life.
Mm-hmm.
But this question of like, how can bad things happen to good people if there's a benevolent God? How did God let it happen? Or if God is all good, why did he create a world where there's evil, where there's suffering? Right? These are the questions that people who even indulge the possibility of God, because many people don't anymore, they come up against this eventually. And I would say that why is it still not resolved is because it's all, the whole conversation is going on a basis of duality, that suffering is bad. It's a presumption that suffering is bad. So how can God be good if he allows suffering?
Mm.
That see, just because of the mechanism of the observation, I'm observing it as a duality. What is good? Good means feeling good, having peace, everything works well, success. And what is bad is what I don't like to feel, is ultimately all it means. Remember, we're just being driven by, I want to feel more of this sensation and I don't want to feel that sensation. I want pleasure and I don't want pain. And that's not a very deep sensitive inquiry into how things work. But there have been throughout history, in all lands of the world, a small minority of very profound thinkers who we call mystics, you know, or who we call those who are experiencing. They're not just the general masses of humanity in every religion of every land through all ages. The general masses soothe themselves with, instead of, you know, the human instinct is to belong to something bigger, to feel safe. That's why people right. paint landscape paintings and do art and stuff, like to feel part of the creation. I'm part of it. If I'm painting this sunset, then it's like it's a religious right. instinct actually to make art. And to feel part of something bigger, to not feel isolated, but to feel included in a divine order. And the masses throughout history, instead of taking shelter of belonging to the actual divinity of life, the wholeness of a sublime creation, they take shelter of their institution and its creeds. And so there's all they have access to, most people, is a concept. Okay, I have this concept. Because this happened, I'm saved. Or because if I believe that, then I'm saved. I have this concept and I believe it if it matches with me, you know, my constitutional sensibilities or cultural indoctrination or whatever. I accept this idea and now I'm part of something bigger that gives me shelter and I feel more safe. But the minority, there's a minority of humans throughout history who are not satisfied on the surface. They're still hungry. They're still thirsty for the substance, not just a concept, but the consciousness of it.
Right.
The
essence.
The experience, the subjective experience of it. I need to be in the consciousness of that. You know, the consciousness of God rather than the concept of God, the concept of salvation. If I believe this concept, then I can believe that I'm saved. It's very different from experiencing the consciousness of salvation and experiencing the consciousness of being made new.
Yeah.
And so there's something, like, for example, Christianity is entirely built upon the example of the suffering of Christ. It's like, you know, this is, I heard this actually in a sermon once in Peru, that in the old days, just the, we can speak from different traditions too. I'm not going to, you know, just speak one tradition. But in the old days, when the Hebrew tribes were wandering in the deserts, under the guidance of Moses, people were getting bitten by the snakes in the desert. And God inspired Moses with some pretty magical shamanistic solution for that snake bite, which is to lift up the snake on a stick. And everybody who looks at the snake, they will be healed of the bite of the snake. They will be survive the poison if they can look at it, you know?
Yeah.
And I heard told one time a pastor in Peru, or a priest in Peru in a Catholic mass, was telling that Christ on the cross is the same thing. Lifting up, like, look at the result of sin. Look at the result. Look at this innocent person, you know, who is being torn to pieces and put to death. Look at the horror of the perversion of the human heart. How far off from our potential as children of God we have come, that we're destroying innocence and goodness and love and a healer and emissary of heaven and grace. All that we could do in response to that is destroy it. And if you look upon that, you know, lifting up Christ on the cross is like, if you look upon the reality of what your incoherence with God's will, you know, what you're part of as part of the collective of humanity, like we are complicit in you know, sustaining in our own ways. But maybe it's indirect. Maybe we don't see that the meat in the supermarket that we eat every day is actually coming from industrial slaughterhouse that's destroying the air and the earth and the water more than anything. Or we don't see that the bananas on our table came from the slaughter of Guatemalan families so that Chiquita Banana could have their, you know, monopoly on the land. We don't see all the murder and violence and destruction of the environment behind our lifestyle. We don't see it, but we're complicit. We're sucking on the teat of profound evil by living in a contemporary society. We didn't choose that. So in a way, it's like, well, it's not really my fault. And, you know, how many, which you have to choose your battles. You only have so much bandwidth to work with. You can't solve right. everything. You can't get away from all the plastic and the petroleum and the violence and the my tax dollars are going to, you know, fund the horrors of, you know, the Gaza, and everything is, it's inescapable, the suffering of life.
Right.
But at least, you know, God is holding up the true tradition, true wisdom is holding up the cross. Like, look at it and let it affect you. It will change you. If you keep your eyes glazed over, if you keep your head stuck in the sand like an ostrich, if you keep trying not to feel and to grieve the wounding that you're experiencing and that your whole species is experiencing and is perpetuating upon itself, if you cannot see the destruction of the world because we are so perverse in our dualism, because of duality, that, you know, at the root, duality is me versus you. So I can take your land, or I can, you know, genocide your people, or I can do whatever suits me because you're an other. You're not included in us. You're them. There's an objectification. Duality implies objectification, whether that's of the animals that people eat, or that's other nations, other races, another gender, or, you know, third genders, or whatever it is that's other than. It's objectified. Well, it's not like us. It's different. There's a permission to negate the sacredness of life in an other. It's all founded, this all comes back to a dualism, a dualistic view. And at the root of it is, if this is a far stretch that you really have to contemplate to see the value of what, you know, the practical value of what I'm talking about. As long as we want pleasure and hate pain, we will always cause destruction. We will cause rupture. Dualism in the heart of the human being. I want this and I hate that. If we're moving in God's creation, if you believe in God, for example, is what you brought up, and you're moving in God's creation, you have no right to hate anything. Then you are opposing the creation of the Creator. So when people say that, how can there be God? How would a good God create evil in the world? Well, he didn't. God created divine order. And the dualism in us, which is a liability of our free will, like God's exclusive interest is love. Exclusive, one-pointed interest, 24 hours a day for eternity. Not any second interest. There's not one second interest in the heart of God, but love. And for there to be love, we require free will, which is a liability. And there's going to be 100 million permutations of the misuse of free will, which just misuse means that we are willing separate from the will of our Creator, whose will is love.
Yeah.
So if we, at a microcosmic level, the spore where it comes from is, I have suffering. There is suffering. God created this world with birth and death. We are made humble by time. If I hate that, now I'm no longer in a creation that's built. I'm not in alignment with the will of God, which is to love. This is a stretch, but I'm going to have to learn to love suffering. I'm going to have to honor what is, you know, love for my wife is one kind of love. Love for a child is another kind of love. Love for nature is another kind of love. And love for suffering is another kind of thing. You know, there's romance, there's friendship, there's compassion, there's devotion for God. Love takes many different shades and hues depending on what its object is. But could you love suffering? What would that mean? I think it would mean honoring and respecting a teacher who's humbling and, you know, leading you by the crisis of ordeal into a deeper knowledge that feeds life. It just like there's a polarity of day and night. There's a polarity of pleasure and pain for a perfectly sublime reason. And as soon as the genesis in the heart of hating anything that exists, I hate it. I don't want it. Whether you articulate that or not, if that's true in your heart, I hate this experience, or I hate the way you make me feel. That means we are rejecting a creation that is actually whole and perfect, including the humbling and difficult parts, are part of a medicine process that a perfect Creator has designed.
So when conceptually understanding, you are able to say with honesty, I hate this, but being able to tap back in too, because the embodied experience of grief would absolutely welcome you to be able to, for instance, not limited to doing anger walks through the woods, telling God what for. Like, this is my honest expression of what I'm feeling right now. And it's getting to the end of that walk and feeling the being held in that and reorienting back to that perspective. But there is a very real first, like, embodied practice of being able to say what's honest and true toward God, and then being able to tap back into that, okay, my understanding of the benevolence, my understanding of what's bigger picture here, which would then lead to so orienting back to the purpose of it, and also the wanting to shift from duality to polarity. What's going to come up? What are we going to confront?
Well, first of all, the phrase is going to be hard for most people. I love suffering. That's ridiculous. This is a completely unrealistic. Tamal, what are you even talking about? You're stuck in theory and abstract models that don't actually land with the human experience if you say we should be loving suffering. Yeah, because just the thought can be either a real healing balm, or it can be like a little useless Band-Aid on an open, terrible wound.
Right.
A thought is very poor consolation for an overwhelming feeling.
Yes.
You know, when you have really intense emotion, really intense suffering, it's so raw. It puts us in a place of such scrambling to bear, scrambling to withstand, scrambling to navigate at all with sanity.
Right. You know,
that a thought, oh, don't worry, it's God's plan, you know.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
It's not going to be positive. And especially if you don't want to say that to someone who is suffering. This is not about applying, like, remember we talked a little bit a few minutes ago about concept and consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
The concept that there's divine order, that the creation is perfect, that suffering is something worthy of honor and that should be received as a grace. That concept is not going to console and not going to bring wisdom. Mm. The contemplation of that,
yes,
and the entering into a state of revelation to cultivate the consciousness of divine order, which is what all, Jesus is going after. He's feeding the masses and teaching, he's going back into the woods and back up the mountain time again and again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just talking concepts. He's immersing himself in a communion. Is it King David says in the, I meditate on your law day and night.
Day and night.
Mm-hmm. I'm chewing on this bread. I'm extracting wisdom. It's an active devotion to understanding God's goodness. There's a presumption, the presumption of devotion is the one to whom you are devoted is worthy of all your love and trust.
Mm.
So the presumption is God is good all the time. Mm. And then to commune, to meditate upon, to contemplate, to prioritize in your life the cultivation of those deeper understandings, to understand how, if God is good all the time, how are you working here? And to seek that. You know, through contemplation, through interior life, whether you have four kids or you live in a monastery, if you're going to be a whole human being, you've got to prioritize internal study. You can't just run on reactivity. I don't like how this feels and I'm freaking out and my coping mechanisms established in childhood are running on automatic again. It's like, that's not going to cut it. Yeah. If you have a calling to be really useful in this world, whatever man, woman, child, whatever your situation is, you're going to have to prioritize spending time with God and meditating on divine order. And there are so many, I spend a lot of time in India, and there are so many traditions of meditation and science of contemplation, the science of, there are deep thoughts in India about the nature of reality. and they don't work as just a concept. It only works as a consciousness. You have to actually work. You know, the concept is a doorway. And if you feel called, like, wow, that seems like if I could understand, if I could really experience that there's a divine order in every moment, all the time, the concept that there's a divine order in every moment, in every situation, all the time, that concept is attractive to me. If I could, the concept is a door, and if I could possibly feel that way, perceive that way, view life through a lens of lucid comprehension of divine order and everything that's happening, including the suffering that I'm not escaping from by battering it with a concept. God is good, God is good, God is good. But this consciousness of divine order is actually putting light in my eyes to show me profound meaning and possibility in what I'm going through or what someone else is going through. Well, that's worth investing in. If you can understand the value of the proposal of such a consciousness, that there's a non-dual nature to reality. Yeah. Non-dual means like there's not a dual, like this versus that. It's non-dual. It's actually polarity. There's a wholeness that includes both birth and death, yeah, both pleasure and pain, both loss and gain, both like exaltation and humbling. There's a wholeness, just like riding a bicycle that has two pedals and they're positioned opposite, but you push on one and the other one comes up, and you push on that one and the other one comes up, and both pedals drive the bike in the same direction. Non-dual reality, the proposal of the broad thinking of the meditators of India, is that there's a non-dual reality, that reality by nature is non-dual, but you're misperceiving it as dual, and therefore you're struggling and fighting. Therefore, you're acting purely on reactivity. You have no access to your actual free will because everything you're doing is a knee-jerk reaction to your projection that something is wrong. You're projecting that something's wrong. And therefore, you're fighting against a reality where the polarity, the reality of experience, it's not escapism. This idea of non-duality is not escapism from any of the feelings. It's a confrontation with the full spectrum of feeling, the full spectrum of experience. But that non-dual reality is only experienced through cultivation, through prayer, meditation. It's the concept of it is only useful in attracting someone who's looking for a solution. Like, that would make sense. That sounds like, if I could see that way, I would have more peace and more free creative response to the situations in my life. So what does a person do to get back, you said, back to that place of the trust? I mean, there's a lot of ways we could actually go talking about that. You know, there's times that you can't, you're overwhelmed with suffering in the moment. And, you know, the point, I think, is not about how do you solve a problem when it's happening? How do you get back in a really centered and peaceful place when you're in difficulty? The point is, when you have the luxury to do so, are you investing your time in cultivating a holy vision of life? So that you're already ready, your instincts are already more calibrated towards seeing the medicine in your difficulty. Because if you haven't cultivated that, when the difficulty comes, it's already too late. You're going to freak out. You're going to fight back. You're going to have a reaction. You're going to have, it's going to run its course as your childhood survival mechanisms kick in. You're going to be running on autopilot until you cool down. You're not going to have an ideal response to suffering and crisis if you haven't been preparing yourself as a lifestyle. If you haven't been cultivating a relationship with suffering where you are waiting for it inevitably to come as a teacher, as a healer, that anything that comes in difficulty is going to show you the places in you that are still not yet faithful, that are still dualistic, that are still incoherent with faith and trust and a sublime, where you're not ready to represent through your embodiment non-dual reality. And therefore, you're still enabling by your very existence and your unconscious vibration, you're also enabling the dualism in the world and the and war. We're implicated in war if we haven't yet resolved our issue with dualism in our heart. We're plugged into a collective consciousness that our way of being feeds. So the more enlightened you are, the more you are feeding into the bloodstream of humanity's collective consciousness and collective potential. And the more that you're not doing the work, the more that you are complicit, an organ of one at one level or other, perpetuating conflict.
Yeah.
In a time when conflict is in season, you know, especially in season.
Yeah.
So unless you're working really hard to not be complicit in that, the age, like a tide, is surely sweeping you along. And no matter what kindness you want to live with, if you're not actually treating the dysfunction of dualism in the heart and learning to bring love to suffering, doesn't mean you have to say, I love suffering. But you could bring love when there's suffering, like St. Francis, where there's darkness, let me sow light, you know, in myself, in my experience, in the experience of my neighbor. You know, let me respond in where there is pain. Am I ready to have a loving response to that and not hate? You know, pure compassion is the last thing I would say. Pure compassion does not involve wanting someone else's situation to change. Like if my friend's going through divorce and his heart is completely broken and he doesn't know what to do about his kids and he's, you know, everything is coming apart at the seams of the life that he's built. And he also is ashamed knowing like he messed up and he wasn't good enough in many ways. Like, then do I pray, let this marriage be saved? Do I pray, let my grandmother not have dementia anymore? Do I pray that my friend who's on a deathbed with cancer get healed? Is that really a perspective that trusts a divine order and resolves duality? Or am I saying this divorce is a bad situation that shouldn't happen? This disease is a bad situation that shouldn't happen? I am taking the position of being the judge. And that's a heavy position to have when you don't really know what's right or wrong in the world in an absolute sense. But you can pray instead for the suffering. I don't know whether it's what's going to happen to your marriage. I don't know whose fault it was. I'm not smart enough. I'm not God. I don't know how to judge. But I do know that your heart is suffering. Let me love that suffering. Let me hold that suffering and not turn it away. Like, I actually can't deal with your suffering. So instead, I'm going to pray that your situation stops so that I don't have to feel your suffering. Or I'm going to pray that my situation stops because I can't deal with my suffering. I hate suffering and I hate it in you, you know? I hate it in you, so I'm going to pray that the situation stops so I don't have to hear about your suffering anymore. Because it's like when a baby's crying and it makes people agitated, because it's like you actually want to cry out inside. And the screaming of a child makes you unnerved because you don't want it resonates with something in you that also wants to scream. And there's something when we hate suffering, our idea of compassion or empathy for another person is like, what can I do to problem solve, troubleshoot your situation? Or if I'm a religious person, I'll pray for it to stop. But really, free-willing love is like, I'm going to bring light where there's darkness. I'm going to love you and your suffering. I'm going to love myself and my suffering. I'm going to bring love as a response to suffering rather than leaving a germ of hate. I hate this experience. Or I hate that you are reminding me of it, and I cover that. Our whole life is an elaborate coping mechanism and a diversion of dissociation from the fact that we hate suffering.
Yeah.
Our life is built entirely on hate, you know, and therefore craving. Do we really love happiness, or do we just hate suffering so much that we want to fill the space with something the opposite? You know, it's like you don't have a real identity as long as your identity is built upon repressing your shadow. If you're trying to prove to yourself and to others that you're good because you're unconsciously afraid of all your shadow content, then all of your activity in the world isn't necessarily good at all. It's just a desperate attempt to prove to yourself and others that you're not the bad thing that you unconsciously think you are. So there's no free-willing, real individuated expression of identity there. It's just a knee-jerk reaction to a fear of. So our whole life, if we hate suffering, everything we do is some kind of reaction and projection and contaminated. It's not genuine. Until we can resolve dualism and like, I'm just going to unify all my experience by bringing love to all of it, by bringing faith and trust to all of it, including like the fact of unavoidable suffering of my others, of myself and others. I'm not going to endeavor or pray to God to make suffering stop, because suffering has never stopped and it will never stop. If I pray to God to make suffering stop, I'm obviously in conflict with the creation that is, which includes suffering for everyone since time immemorial. In this embodied life, there is suffering. If I can't accept it, I don't accept the creation as a whole, and therefore I'll never understand how it works. I'll never be able to follow God's lead and understand his laws while I'm objecting to and hating his creation. He has created suffering. He didn't create evil. No, that's our permutation of free will. You know, But suffering is there. Embodied life is built in suffering. It's unavoidable.
So part of the coming to a better reorientation to suffering is obviously, as you said, removing the duality, the good and the bad of the suffering, or only wanting to experience pleasure and not pain. And then what's going to be confronted is a lot of the ways that, one, there's not conscious connection to divine or to God to be able to seek the wisdom. So there's that's needed, an opening of our eyes, of being able to see clearly where it's dim, that there would be some clarity. And also the disassociation, which you mentioned, I know on I guess that was yesterday, you gave an example and it just was like, hold on, I need a minute. which, by the way, I think it's amazing. I meant to say this at the beginning. The first time I ever heard you talk was on a Zoom call. And when you were talking, I just said, if you've ever seen Star Wars, it's like all when you're at light, super light speed, or I can't remember what it's called, but and you're just like all the stars are like shining by, like listening to you is like this stars of like all this information in my brain is processing. And then like, I'm getting some of it, but then there's so much more going by that I'm like, I'm going to go back and I'm going to look at that. Anyway, so it's just fascinating the way that you communicate and get me thinking. But what I wanted to say was, and I lost my train of thought. I said, Tamal, you've been to India, you've seen suffering. You've seen suffering, I'm sure, in Peru. You've been to these other countries and like navigating that and seeing that. How do you process that? And you were like, you explained the ways that someone on the street was dealing with their suffering and the laying down. You gave the example and then you just hit it with how we do that in America. Can you kind of dive? Because what I'm trying to get to is the vein of the disassociation that we can tend to have when we're unable to look at the suffering, like you, Moses lifting up the rod or Jesus on the crucifixion, when it's hard for us to look. And so we will disassociate, whether it's the suffering in our own life, suffering in our communities, suffering on the global scale, the ways that we will disassociate. Could you give that or talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the ways are myriad, and it's to presume, I would assert, that humanity in general doesn't have the capacity. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, one of the reasons that we don't have the capacity is we don't have rites of passage anymore. In the old days, different, like the Lakota people, for example, they would do something called hambletia, a vision quest. When a young boy turns 12 or 14 or something, he would go out and fast on a mountain for 4 days. You know, take a pipe, the chinupa, the peace pipe, which is considered for Lakota people like a telephone to God. You know, you really want to talk to the Creator, you need to lift this pipe. It's given by the Creator as like a sacrament. It's like, when you need me and you really want me to listen, you want my attention and you want a vision, you want guidance, lift this pipe because it's sacred to me. And so a young person would go out, sit on a mountain and fast for 4 days while they've been prepared for it by their elders and initiated adults of their clan. And while they're being prayed for, the whole time a fire is lit and everybody's praying for them up there, and you go alone and you don't sleep and you don't eat and you don't drink and you hold this pipe and you wait, God, please come, Creator, please come and give me a vision about how I can serve my people. What am I for? Like, every animal in the ecosystem has a role, an interdependent symbiotic role to play. So human being is our individuation, our coming of age, our initiation is to, what is my medicine? What is life need for me? That's my special satisfaction to have something meaningful to give. And part of initiation is you're trying to come back down that mountain with something to give. And you're ready to be an adult. You're ready to start adulthood. Initiation means you're going from being you're no longer a child who's totally dependent and, you know, not really useful to the people, besides being cute and inspiring us that the next generation is cute.
Yeah.
And besides being a juvenile who's, you know, in a combustion of questioning themselves and questioning everything, they're confused. Yeah. We really need adults, which is people who An adult means someone who can come back down the mountain, come back from a rite of passage, knowing that life is hard and ready to carry their weight for their people, for society. Adult means that. Like, I'm not hiding from the fact that life is hard. I'm going to be vulnerable for my whole life. There will be suffering. There will be death. I am burdened with a vocation. The Creator asked me to give something, to carry the weight of the people, to steward life on earth in my little corner of creation. I'm responsible here. It's on me. And it's hard. And it's going to be hard until I die. That's adulthood, is to like come to peace with that. It's going to be hard until I die. If you can't accept that, then you remain child or juvenile in your consciousness. Mm. And children and juveniles, they're not really able to contribute to society. They can't help create a shelter for others. They need to be sheltered, and juveniles in particular are like a dangerous position because they're in between needing to be sheltered and disturbing the shelter that they're in.
And I have four of those juveniles, yeah.
Right, so you're definitely in the initiation process. Crisis of ordeal.
Yes.
But one way or another, there needs to be a very raw, whether it's fasting and feeling for 4 days and four nights, like your mortality. If you fast for 4 days on a mountain, you will feel your mortality. And you know, like the whole, all my people are waiting for me to come back successful. Like, I need to pray here in such a way that I get a real living vision and come back to my people. This is my chance. Mm. I need to come down from this mountain. It's deeply and totally important that I get in contact, that I get a revelation of what is my adult responsibility. I need to know what that is and orient to that henceforth. And also that comes in the context of feeling your frailty. They're fasting up there. Or in different cultures, like Maladoma Somme, in his book of Water and Spirit, he speaks about his initiation in Africa and his tribe, the Dogara. I think they're the Dogara people. And it's just like people, the young boys, they go out into the bush for initiation, and not all of them survive and come back. There's a full confrontation with the frailty of your embodied life. And then you're going to come back and you're going to be an adult by bearing the responsibility, the burden of life is always going to be hard. And also that you're always going to be vulnerable. You could die at any time and you don't forget that. Or your loved ones could die, or there could be disease, or like to live with eyes open to the snake, to the cross, to the fact of suffering is adulthood. Mm. You know, and it used to be that the Lakota people, the Dogara people, the Celtic people, the whichever people your people came from way back when, they would initiate you at the right moment when your biology was actually becoming adult. They would make sure that your psychology also became adult at that time. They wouldn't let you stay within an adult body with a juvenile or child psychology. They would create the conditions where it may risk your life, but you're going to confront full on directly the frailty of your mortal existence and your fear. And when you have confronted it and you come back, something's different about you. If you never confront it like a child, hiding behind something else your whole life to not confront, then you never become an adult. So when we talk about how do people dissociate from suffering and go numb and turn off and distract themselves, well, in this day and age, practically everyone, the entire human society, is dissociated because we have lost the old ways, the ancestral wisdom that would make sure that young people were initiated into the psychological wholeness of adulthood. We don't do that now. And that's why, like in America, you have so many like nursing homes and things where we put the old people away also, because if you didn't become an adult, you certainly didn't become an elder. And nobody wants to take care of a juvenile, you know. You know, we don't respect our old people because for the most part, they're not actually elders who are the most precious. It should be that our elders and our newborns, our little kids, are the most precious. Everybody else in society is working to take care of the elders that have been through the whole arc of dealing as adults with the reality of human suffering and walking with God and serving people and carrying their adult responsibility till they have ripened like fine wine into something that feeds everybody. You don't have to cook anymore or work the corn anymore, grandpa, grandma. You are the ripened wine of human richness because of dealing consciously with suffering for your whole life. But our societies, do not deal with suffering, do not initiate us into the reality of it, and give us 100 million ways, especially through the internet and every kind of media dissociation, to not confront the fact of our suffering. And so now it's a snowball where we are so constipated with unprocessed fear of the reality of suffering, and we are so much addicted to every kind of coping mechanism, every kind of distraction, that for the masses at this moment right now, on the 10th of February, whatever the date is today, at 6 p.m., 7 p.m., that kind of the consciousness of life is not available to most people. It's just not, it's not an option right now. The juggernaut, the momentum, the snowball of collective dissociation and juvenile and childish fear without elders that showed us by their example that you can cross over, you can face your fears and become an adult. We don't have those people anymore. So there's no proof it can be done. So everybody's afraid, like children and juveniles and acting like juveniles. Now you have juveniles in positions of power over the globe, and it's not safe. You know, we don't have grown-ups. We don't have people that accept the difficulty of suffering. They just all want to feel more pleasure, more pleasure, more pleasure. And that becomes like power over feels pleasure. Now that feels like confidence. That feels like security rather than God's divine order. And the maturity of being in alignment with the laws of nature and spirit, because you accept them and you know, conform to the pattern of the creation as it is, and you become a beautiful flower of the creation rather than a perversion, a mutation.
So again, my brain so many different ways, but what I'm, what's landing is, I know you said we don't have that. And I think that I do want to push on that, because I feel like we do. There are expanders of that. I mean, you're an expander of that for me. And the mystics and those that are, you said of the example, the conversation that we were going to have today wasn't for the ones who were completely
right. Disabled. Exactly. Yeah.
It's for the people who are awake and wanting to be conscious and are leading those in that process, of which you are, to me, one of those that is doing that. It is the healers that we see, or the people that are having the conversations that are seeing, like, hey, we need a shift. There needs to be both a cultural shift, an ancestral shift. Like, we need to return back to these processes that bring us back to essentially that polarity view of God being benevolent, God being good. And what does that mean in our life if we shift, allow that to shift the way that we think and the way that we approach our world? What would be, okay, so knowing that maybe we're speaking to the people, the ones that are with us, they're like, I'm awake to this and I enjoy hearing about this. What, in closing us up, what would you say is the takeaway, the practical embodiment that you would encourage them, knowing what we've discussed tonight?
I would say, like, the convenient little sticky note.
Sorry. Yes, I'm trying.
A sticky note to keep in your pocket. You know, it's like a seed. If you water this seed, because of the conversation, the time we have right now is short, we're wrapping up. If you take this seed with you and you water it carefully, it will open the coating of everything. My experience is, and my conviction is, and my message is, if you consider that the whole process, the task is to transform dualism into polarity. You consider that deeply. Let that question, what does that mean, be a guiding force, that it will decode all the mysteries of whatever's relevant to know about being a whole person and making a meaningful contribution, and how relationships work, how marriages work, how healing works, how the laws of society can be worked. It's like, that's what Parmenides and these old original philosophers were doing, is learning the codes of nature upon which everything is built. What Da Vinci was understanding through studying music and wrestling and anatomy and art and, you know, herbology. What is this universal code of life that, you know, it's like a skeleton key that opens everything. I would say this is a skeleton key to open everything. So that's one thing I would say. There's a little sticky note. You want a thought to think about? The task is, the problem is, the only problem is dualism, which means like dueling, like high noon. Which one is going to win this time? The blues or the reds? You know, the left or the right or the, you know.
Yeah.
It's dualism is the problem. You know, it's not this political leader or this regime or this war, this new war, or this old. It's dualism. If you want to get to real solutions, a root of solution, you know, because suffering is inherent in life. But there is a problem in the world that seems to be asking for a response. You know, there's a problem. There's something, we don't even have to call it a problem. There's a task that's asking for a response. Yeah. Some kind of healing response. And dualism is the diagnosis of the disease. And it's founded on a misunderstanding of the polarity that's there.
Yeah.
Dualism means there's a polarity and I just hate half of it. That's dualism. Polarity means there's a polarity that's there, opposite things, but they're working together for one ultimate purpose. All things work together for the good. All things work together. That's polarity. So that's the sticky note, the little sutra, you know, to the seed, to water. And on the other hand, I would say, you know, like you were mentioning, this conversation, it's not for the masses. It's not for most people who do not have the support or the internal resources to be able to take on the fact of suffering anymore. They're too crippled by culturally indoctrinated escapism and dissociation. And weakness, to be honest, because they're not shown by their elders how to be adult anymore, how to deal with the suffering of life with eyes open and heart open. We're not shown that example, so I don't blame the world for being weak. You know, once it's broken, the example, the generational transmission of initiation, rites of passage, then it's a tragic loss. It's like the common people will have never had on their own. Human beings on their own don't have the potential to individuate just by bootstrap theory.
Yeah.
But if someone is called, feels a vocation, a calling to be part of responding to suffering in the world, to be part of a solution, whatever that might, whatever the proper language is for a world that's all... And this is the paradox, is that there is, on one hand, a divine order and divine creation, and everything from the eyes of the mystic, everything is fine. Everything's okay as it is. It's all acceptable. It's all acceptable. And on the other hand, there's passion in the heart of God to intervene for our suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a dispassionate enlightenment that's like, whoa, I can see, actually, that there's a divine order to everything, and I'm not burdened with judging the world or saving the world. I can relax to the core of my being because God's creation is perfect. That's a dispassionate, enlightened view. And it is complemented in polarity with a passionate, enlightened view, which is that God's heart, while offering free will and accommodating free will within his perfect design of creation, is also passionate that all living beings know love. And that will never stop, because the only reason we're in trouble is because there's free will, because there has to be free will, because God's desire is love. So we're created with free will because God wants us to have the chance at love. And it wouldn't be love if there's not free will. Now we're suffering. And the suffering has to be there because there has to be free will. But God still cares about that suffering and still wants that aren't living in the wholeness of love should receive it.
That's right.
And so the pattern, the historical pattern is, if you want to be part of that, first of all, giving up the illusion that something is that you need to judge something and fight against something. And on the other hand, being inspired and empowered in unity with God's love for the world. If you want to be a glove on the hand of the all-loving supreme being, you know, then the pattern, the historical pattern is you need initiation, you need training, you need elders, you need some help. Yes. You're going to need to dedicate yourself. Like if you want to be a doctor, you know what that means? What that's going to cost you to be a doctor?
Yeah.
You know what kind of dedication and sacrifice and consistency and long suffering it's going to take if you just want to be a physical doctor? if you want to be a healer of society, a healer of consciousness, a healer even of individuals' broken hearts, that you could be like those chaplains you talked about who can say something relevant, whatever the culture of the people they're sitting with, who could speak a living word. If you want to be that useful person who can bring medicine, bring healing where hearts are cracked, then that's even more than being a physical doctor. You're going to have to dedicate your whole life to training in that. It's going to have to be a priority. And it's like, even if you've got kids, if there's no excuse, if you're called to that, being an adult means it's hard work to be an adult. And it's always going to be hard work. And making peace with that, it's burdensome to be conscious. It's a burden. It's painful to look upon the face of the suffering of the world, especially when you don't have people to lean on around you doing it with you. Right. It's painful to be awake. It's difficult. And that pain and that burden, they will make you more and more beautiful and more potent and more loving. The longer that you gaze upon them and know that they are your teachers, they are making you better. Gazing upon your own suffering and the suffering of others with open eyes will make you better and better. Fighting it, denying it, hating it will keep you in a loop of reactivity that will never change, and you're just carried along with the unconscious masses, one more organ of a mass movement of conflict with reality. You're going to have conflict with another political party or conflict with your spouse if you're in conflict with reality.
Right.
Everything is symptoms. The disease is you're in conflict with reality.
Yeah.
And so whatever lens, I'm not going to, you know, there's Buddhists that do it without referring to the concept of God at all. But somehow or other, whatever works for you as an individual in your individuation process, everybody who has this calling to be part of help, you know, to bring medicine, to expand the beautiful goodness of life. If you're called to be part of that, you're going to have to find the teacher or teachers or cosmovision framework, rites of passage, and the training and everything you need to grow mature and to be shaped and formed to rehabilitate yourself from your own dualism until you really are fully at peace with reality as it is, and therefore free of reactivity and projection. You're free to be inspired and moved as an agent of love. You know? Or you can actually be an agent of, like the alchemists of old were trying to turn iron into gold. You can be that healer, that mentor, that friend who shows up in someone else's terrible grief-struck circumstance and lays such a hand and such a living word of conscious love upon it that it becomes medicine for that person and not just torture.
I love that. And you can also feel free to be like Jesus and go get in the woods too for that initiation.
It takes a lot of study.
It does. Yeah.
He had 3 years of ministry.
Yes.
And even in that time, he was in the woods most of the time, you know, coming in and out. So how much the majority, look at that, how much public time versus how much time in the laboratory, you know, as an example, he's being an example. And the vast majority of his time was alone in communion, you know, practicing as a human example, conforming to the divine will of God. Unconditional, where he's like, oh, he's afraid still to die, but ultimately he didn't hate his own death even.
Yeah.
And therefore it became medicine for thousands of years now.
Right. And that ritual alone can be so incredibly confronting if you've never grown up in the ritual where you know how to be alone with yourself, period. And much less, you know, going into the, I mean, I remember me having to learn how to be okay with going places by myself to now where I crave it. Like it is a necessity for me to be alone on the beach, in the woods, wherever, daily, and also as much as possible in real life. But that is also, that's a learned skill and capacity building, just like it's a privilege too. So there's some people don't have that same thing, but conceptually this can look a lot of different ways for a lot of different people.
Totally.
And it's, connecting to that. Tamal, thank you so much.
Yeah.
I know we could have, and like we can keep going because there's so many different.
Well, I hope it was sensible what I said. I hope I just wasn't a bunch of blabbing. And, you know, sometimes I get talking fast. There's a lot, you know, and I hope it has some sense and some clarity in there.
Absolutely. And one of those, like, even though the I'm at warp speed and the stars are traveling, I've got it recorded. So I, every time I'll come back and be able to listen and gain something new. Can you tell the listeners where they could find you? Let's say if they wanted more information about the School of Prayer in your online community, where could they find you?
Yeah, very soon, any day now. I'm not very technologically savvy, but I'm after months trying to find about to work out how to have my online school up, a little space where I can, I'm regularly teaching things for those who aren't local to me, where I do retreats or things like that. The easiest thing would be to find me there. It's going to be Moonshine Mundali. Moonshine dash Mundali is mandali.mn.co. MN is Mighty Networks. It's like,
yeah, the yeah, app.
I'm just figuring it out. It's like a school community hosting thing. So it's yeah. Moonshine dash Mundali, mandali. .mn.co.
Okay.
And
I'll link that to
that's one thing. Yeah, that's probably the easiest thing. Or if somebody really wants to get in touch, they could maybe they reach out to you and you can give them my number.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh yeah. Well, I just realized, sorry.
Yeah,
I
no,
just
go ahead.
I just created a couple of days ago an Instagram. I already forgot.
Oh. Okay.
I'm trying to come out of the cave.
Yeah, you
I'm trying to come out of the cave and make myself available. You know, I need to be busy also trying to help. You know, it's a burden on my consciousness to not be available enough. So I did make an Instagram. It's Tamal, T-A-M-A-L dot Kunj, K-U-N-J. And
okay.
An Instagram, Tamal dot Kunj.
I'll put that in the show notes too.
Cool.
Okay. Tamal, thank you so much for being here.
Lovely to be with you, Rachel. I love spending time with you.
Oh, same, same. Okay, everybody, thank you for listening to today's episode. And I hope that you guys have a great day wherever you are.